Welcome to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. It is Monday, October 3rd. Lutherans for Life conference just around the corner. Today, we'll have a chance to talk with some of the presenters for the Lutherans for Life conference coming up later on this month. I want to say thanks to our underwriter, Concordia University, Wisconsin. Find out more about them on our website, kfuo.org. Look for the CUW logo in the sponsor section. Joining me by phone now, the Reverend Don Richmond, Lutherans for Life International Representative. Pastor Richmond, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Looking forward to learning about your work with Lutherans for Life as International Representative and your presentation at the upcoming conference, Eastern Europe and Russia, The Next Generation to Kill or to Keep. Pastor Richmond, tell me a little bit about how you got involved with Lutherans for Life and your work as International Representative.
Well, it started when I had been a pastor missionary in Brazil working with university students. Then came back to America, worked in North Dakota for about 3.5 years, then got a call to a church here in Bloomington, Minnesota, actually Emmaus Lutheran Church. And probably just a few months after we got here, I read a little announcement in a local Lutheran newspaper of some kind, that there would be a group called Lutherans for Life meeting over at Concordia College in St. Paul, about 20 minutes away from me. So my wife and I drove over there in about a foot of snow, got there, and there we met Dr. Gene Garten, Dr. Eichhorst, Dave Wendy, and a few of the other people that you've heard about in the Lutherans for Life circles. And the concern was already there, but I'd never known how to express this concern until we discovered, Lutherans for Life was actually in formation, was just being born at that time. So that's how I got started with Lutherans for Life.
And what is your work, your chief responsibility as international representative?
Well, actually, I am a pastor missionary for a group we organize. By we, I mean several people from different Lutheran churches. I happen to belong to the Association of Free Lutheran Churches, whose headquarters is here in the Minneapolis area, but there are other groups as well. But these are basically Lutherans who are concerned, who are, I would say, conservative, biblically conservative, and who are concerned about the issues of life. And so we started this as I traveled in Eastern Europe, and I preach and teach normally in a pastoral way, but always at the very front of my agenda was the issue of life. And I found that there were people over there waiting, wanting to hear about this, wanting someone to care, wanting someone to come alongside of them and help do something. So that's how it started. Probably the first expression of this was in Latvia, where I was asked to speak, and there was a couple over there. They're actually Latvian Americans, but when the wall came down, when freedom came, they went back to Latvia to be missionaries. And Irbis family over there. And they invited me to speak in their village, which I did. And this led then to forming a group over there, having a conference. Actually, we had several conferences as the years went by. And so that just started to snowball. And we found concern and interest wherever we went.
Tell me about the culture in that part of Europe. How has that culture shaped the view of life there? What is their regard for human life in that culture? And how does that compare to our understanding here in the United States?
Well, bear in mind that Latvia, the Baltic countries, and all of those countries over there were under the communist, the atheistic umbrella. And, of course, their view of life was an expression of their atheism. And actually, it's a kind of a history to see how the abortion mentality developed over there. I think it was under Vladimir Ulyanov or Lenin where abortion was introduced and legalized. And abortion became a huge thing in Russia. Interestingly, under Stalin, abortion was made illegal, and of course not for any theological or other reasons other than they needed people for their armies, needed people for their self-protection. And so for a while, abortion was illegal, but then it came back. And in Russia, it was easy to see the results of that. For example, in, I think it was 1920, they were the first country to legalize abortion. As a matter of fact, the infamous suction device that is used very commonly here was invented in Russia. 1965, for example, there were 520,000 live births, 546,000 abortions. 2011, it was banned. 2013, it had begun to change, 1,901,000 live births, 880,000 abortions. And interestingly, Vladimir Putin has banned advertisement. They are trying to curtail abortion. Why? Because the population level was decreasing very rapidly. And now, to offset that, they actually incentivize having babies. The first baby, there's no reward. But the second child, if I'm not mistaken, they are giving a reward of $10,000 for the second, third, or subsequent children. So Russia is trying, of course, to reverse the decrease in population and trying to protect it, self-protection. So they're motivating people to try to have babies now, and it's having an effect. I think it was, let's see, I just saw these statistics. Well, take, for example, the city of Ulyanovsk, which is Lenin's hometown and a city where I've done a lot of work. I've worked along with the local pastor there, and they were paying 250,000 rubles, which would have been, I suppose, about $10,000, to have the second child. A year later, there were three times as many children born, so their efforts are being met with success over there. Some success, I should say.
Would you say that poverty or affluence affects the, you know, the public opinion on life issues in that part of Europe and in Russia?
I would say yes. For example, the Russian government moved people from private homes into these large apartment complexes, thousands of people. But the apartments were very small. Sometimes you would have one, two, three families into those little apartments. Well, it was obviously very difficult for them to have more children at that time. And so often a Russian family would be satisfied to have one child because, of course, they had to have a replacement. And the mothers, particularly mothers, were concerned about having someone who would care for them as they got older. So a lot of times they would have one child, maybe two, three would be considered a huge family, but very unusual. As a matter of fact, I've heard this remark several times, that Russian doctors somehow trained to give preference to abortion. And a mother who could come in, and I've heard this different times, and even for the first child, the doctor would suggest abortion. But if she wanted to have her first child, she could. But the second child, and then after that, the third or fourth child, there was almost war declared on that mother for having more than one or at the most two children. So it was very difficult for them to have children. As a matter of fact, I know of a couple who studied at Concordia Seminary there in St. Louis not too long ago. And she tells the story that even her own mother waged war against her for having more than one and even a lot more if she had more than two children. So that was a common practice in Russia during those times, during the Soviet times.
What other things influence social norms when it comes to these life issues? Obviously, government.
I would say this. As is well known, Russia became an atheist country. And so the whole concept of a person being created in the image of God, of a person being bought, paid for with the price of the blood of the life of Jesus, that simply didn't exist over there. And as a result, human life became cheap. It was totally utilitarian. All we need are workers. And if we have workers, that's fine. And so we find that where there is biblical Christianity, where the gospel is preached, where Jesus is accepted as not only Savior, but as Lord of their life, and where the Bible is respected and read and loved, there people will defend and love children and want children, even though it might be difficult to have that third or fourth or fifth child. But that child is still going to be welcomed because of the spiritual foundation in the life of that mother or father.
What will you be presenting at the upcoming conference?
Well, I want to talk about these statistics. What happens when we lose the sanctity of life? What happens when the sacredness, the value of a human being is lost? He's seen only as in a utilitarian way. And then I also want to present how we develop and understand a biblical worldview with regard to human life. What gives life its worth? And not only in former Soviet Union, but here in America, because we have the same issue. We have one political party that is four square, that is solidly in favor, in supporting, and advocating for abortion. We have another political party that stands for life. What makes the difference? What is the underlying influence that makes the difference? And I want to encourage people to not only believe, because we have a lot of pastors in my church, the Free Lutheran Church, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, I'd say probably a vast majority are strongly pro-life. But at the same time, we hear very little preaching. I ask people, have you heard a sermon, a pro-life message, say, in the last year or two? And a lot of times people will say, no, we've never heard that. Well, why? So I want to encourage and to discuss ways of breaking through where we pastors can not only understand, but we can preach it and we can teach it in appropriate ways where God has given us opportunities to do so.
Would you say that, well, are there parts of the world that are more life-affirming than other parts of the world? Are there regions of the world or specific countries and cultures that are more life-affirming in general?
Well, I think in some countries, abortion was never legalized, but by and large, at least in the Western world where I travel, and I used to live in Brazil, it's where people are aware of and they take seriously the biblical foundation of life. How do we understand the value of human life? Well, that's biblical. We are aware, for example, in Old Testament times, when they rebelled against God, pretty soon there was child sacrifice. They adopted the Canaanite religion, the Canaanite worldview, where children could be sacrificed in hopes that it would improve the lifestyle of the parents. Well, that's pretty much the case in our Western world today. I would have to say, however, that America probably has the most lenient laws that I know of in the world with regard to abortion. Because as we know, in most cases, abortion is legal from the time of conception until just before birth. And even in Russia, it's more difficult to get a late-term abortion than it would be here in America. So we have repudiated the biblical foundation of the sanctity of life in our country. It's part of our rebellion against God. And so we want to discuss that. We want to look at that more carefully. And then to say, all right, this is the situation, this is the sickness. What can we do? What can we contribute to change this, to turn it around? And I think I want to say that just believing the right things, of course, is vitally important. That's the beginning. But I also want to say we have to go beyond just believing right. We have to act right. We have to begin to take action. So I want to motivate pastors and lay people, Christian leaders, to take action, to no longer be silent, to break the silence, I think it would probably summarize it.
Would you say that there are some voices in global society that are louder, that have more influence when it comes to life issues or matters of influence the world against life and having more of this death or this culture of death?
Well, let me start out on the positive. In terms of for life, I believe the people that have the biggest voice are those who occupy pulpits every Sunday or maybe twice a week, pulpits and teaching podiums. We have a responsibility to speak for life in the name of Jesus, surrounded with the gospel of Jesus, the saving gospel. On the other hand, those who are probably the most dangerous, at least in our Western world, are those who also occupy pulpits but have turned against the biblical teaching, the solid biblical teaching of life. And then that's eventually reflected in the political, the politics we develop. And so we look today and we see whole political parties that have devoted themselves to making abortion easier, making it more common, making it cheaper for the individual. And that, to me, is a huge tragedy. But having said that, I believe, too, that is at least in big part a result of the silence of the pulpits on the issue.
What parts of the world will be represented at the upcoming conference, October 21st and 22nd?
Well, we have our pro-life representatives from Latvia, and Janis and Jeva Diakons. And I don't know of people coming from other countries, but I do know that Janis and Jeva will be coming. I stay with them in their home frequently when I go to Latvia. They will be staying with us a good part of the time they're here. And by the way, they will be here for almost a month, and so I'm sure would be available to speak and to encourage people in congregations or wherever they might be invited, or colleges, universities, anything like that.
So there are there are Christians, particularly Lutherans all around the world, who take a stand for these life issues as well. This is not just folks in North America. These are folks around the world who take a stand for these issues.
I would say so. I would agree with that. And usually those who take a stand for life, who articulate life issues, would be those who are conservative. And by conservative, I mean they conserve biblical teaching. They are Christ-centered. They are taught to love and honor and respect life by Jesus himself, and they accept that. However, I would say that in most other countries, even Christian believers are probably more passive. They are not... It's not easy for them to organize and articulate certain points. Now, as example, I met he's an LCMS or former LCM missionary in Russia, Pastor Leif Kamp. Some of you may know him. And we happened to meet, and as we were riding in a car from the seminary of the Ingrian Lutheran Church in Russia, and riding to his home in the city of St. Petersburg, it didn't take us long to discover that we were both very pro-life people. And so they became pro-life advocates in the Ingrian Lutheran Church in Russia, in the St. Petersburg area, and of course, throughout different parts of Russia. And of course, through them, we were able to discover other pastors and workers in that church who are pro-life. But even there, and Leif Kamp and I will try to have a pro-life conference at least once a year over there, even there, it's difficult to get people to come out. They believe the right things, but to become active is quite difficult. I'd also say in Latvia, as I mentioned earlier, with the missionaries that were there, we found that they too were very pro-life, and they became active workers in developing a pro-life message in Latvia. And actually, a fruit of their work would be Janis Diakons, who's coming here tomorrow, actually.
What are you looking forward to most about the Lutherans for Life National Conference?
Well, I am looking forward. What I would like to see is those of us who are there, I would say, we are pro-life. That's why we're there. We want to encourage one another. We want to pray together. We want to ask the Lord to act. But my personal objective would be to see people get out and become more articulate individuals in their homes, in their congregations, wherever they have a platform to speak on an individual basis, sharing with friends, talking about pro-life. In other words, it must be a message that is articulated. By and large, particularly we Lutherans tend to be a little bit quiet. And we need to know how to articulate that message.
Certainly there will be opportunities to do that at the Lutherans for Life conference.
Well, I certainly want to talk about it, and I will certainly look for opportunities to, so that we can learn how to do it. How do you approach a person about it, and how do you talk to them in a manner that is not offensive, but it is still loyal, still faithful to truth? And so that is that will be a big part of my objective. But I also, my objectives share what's happening in Eastern Europe and in Russia so that we can be a people who pray, who look beyond our own borders, but at the same time who begin at home so that every one of us becomes a voice for life.
The Reverend Don Richmond, Lutherans for Life International Representative, speaking at the upcoming conference, October 21st through the 22nd at St. Michael's Lutheran Church in Bloomington, Minnesota. Pastor Richmond, thanks for being my guest today on Faith and Family.
And thank you for having me. And God bless you, and may God bless our conference.
Well, thank you. God bless you, too.
Thank you.
Coming
Bye.
Up in just a little bit, we'll talk with Dr. Sheila Page. She'll be speaking at the conference as well. She's a physician. She'll be speaking on legislation and medical perspectives on end of life, how we can make a difference, as well as pain perception, the developing human. You're listening to Faith and Family on Worldwide KFUO.
Concordia University, Wisconsin in Mequon overlooks a half mile of beautiful Lake Michigan shoreline. CUW campus is located 15 miles north of Milwaukee, with over 70 undergraduate majors, 28 graduate degree programs, and doctorate programs in pharmacy, physical therapy, occupational therapy, and nursing practice. CUW offers online learning and accelerated learning at one of 9 Wisconsin centers and one in St. Louis. Traditional or accelerated education, CUW has the program for you. CUW.edu.
This is Life Issues with Brad Mattis, president of Life Issues Institute.
Pro-abortion activists say abortion must remain legal so it will be safe. For the woman, I presume, because the baby dies a horrible death. But legal abortion doesn't mean safe abortion. Rick Van Thiel was arrested for doing abortions in a grimy trailer behind his house in Las Vegas. He learned to do them from watching YouTube videos. Legal abortionist Michael Roth was known as the trunk abortionist and arrested when police found abortion equipment and remains in the trunk of his car. Legal abortionist James Pendergraft was arrested when police found abortion instruments covered with evidence of his grisly practice in his car. He traveled up and down the interstate doing abortions. Making abortion legal hasn't made abortion safe. Babies are killed and women are hurt.
Like us on Facebook at Life Issues and stay informed, more informed than you've ever been.
God's word is our great heritage and shall be ours forever. To spread its light from age to age shall be our chief endeavor. I'm William Whedon, LCMS Director of Worship, inviting you to be sure and join us as we romp through chapter after chapter of the Sacred Scriptures, rejoicing in the salvation that's ours in Jesus Christ. Join us.
Thy Strong Word, weekday mornings at 11 on Worldwide KFUO. Underwritten by Lutheran Heritage Foundation, lhfmissions.org.
Hi, this is Rich Robertson, President and CEO of the Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Each day, we at LCEF are energized by you, the members of the LCMS. People's lives are transformed by the gospel, and the world can witness that change through your actions. LCEF is blessed to share in these experiences as people like you invest so that loans and critical services are available for ministries and church leaders. We're encouraged by you and your action and inspired to be there for you. Check out lcef.org.
Worldwide KFUO has been listener-supported since 1924, teaching the good news of Jesus' life, death, and resurrection for our sins, and witnessing to the world about God's mercy. We are on AM 850 in St. Louis and a click away 24 hours a day at kfuo.org. If you have questions about donating, you can email us, gifts@kfuo.org. Join Lutheran Immigration and Refugee Service and thousands of congregations across the country as they observe Refugee Sunday, a time to celebrate the gifts migrants and refugees bring to the United States. Pick a Sunday that works best for your congregation to celebrate. New resource kits, including bulletin insert and poster, will be available soon. Sign up for our newsletter at lirs.org/rebuildinghope.
KFUO embracing today's technologies to bring the good news message of Christ to the world. Listening to Worldwide KFUO on the go with your smartphone doesn't mean you have to walk around with earbuds all day. You can Bluetooth or sync up to listen in your car while driving anywhere. There are many easy ways to listen to WorldwideKFUO.org. On the air, online, and on demand, the messenger of good news, Worldwide KFUO.
Welcome back to Faith and Family. I'm Andy Bates. We are talking with presenters of the Lutherans for Life 2016 National Conference. Here We Stand, taking place at St. Michael's Lutheran Church in Bloomington, Minnesota, October 21st and 22nd. You can find information on their website, lutheransforlife.org, taking a look at a number of issues that we face every day here, not only in the United States, but as we spoke with Pastor Richmond, this is really a worldwide issue. And so we want to take a look at this from certainly the affirming perspective as we affirm life. Our next guest, Dr. Sheila Page, associate scholar with the Charlotte Lozier Institute and board certified in neuromusculoskeletal medicine and osteopathic manipulative medicine. Dr. Page, welcome to Faith and Family.
Thank you. How are you doing?
Oh, very well. How are you today?
I'm doing great.
Thanks for taking some time to talk with us today. Tell us a little bit about your work in osteopathic manipulative medicine and neuromusculoskeletal medicine. Tell us a little bit about that for those of us not familiar with this type of medicine.
Okay. Well, it's an osteopathic philosophy, and the application of that philosophy. I use manual medicine in treatment of people with a wide variety of illnesses and diseases. Most of my patients have some kind of pain, and I treat children also with craniofacial problems and the neurological problems associated with that. And also, I will treat people who are suffering at the end of their life to help improve the quality of their life, that the drugs and the other medicine can't quite impact the way manual medicine can.
As a physician, how do you regard life, and how does that impact your decision to become a physician?
Well, I view life as precious, and all of my patients are very special to me. And the reason I keep going is because of my patients. They inspire me, and they keep me moving in the direction of trying to fight for their lives and their health and well-being. And that's really the reason I keep going is my patients and the relationship that I have with them.
What is, let's talk about, you have two presentations coming up, the National Lutherans for Life Conference, legislation, medical perspectives on end of life, how we can make a difference, and pain perception in the developing human. And that's the one I'd like to talk about first, is pain perception in the developing human. You mentioned earlier that many of the patients you serve are facing some kind of pain. And so that's why you are in the practice that you're in to help them with that pain. How in the past was pain perception understood by those in the medical community? How has pain perception been understood, and have there been changes in the not so distant past that have changed how we look at medicine, how in terms of pain and caring for those in pain?
Wow, that's a
loaded question.
Yes.
How have we looked at pain in the past, and how it's perceived?
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a common human experience. And so as physicians, we are trained to anticipate that someone will have pain, and it's our job to intervene and try to alleviate that pain when possible. And it's not always possible to make someone completely pain-free, and we recognize that. And so as much as we try, our goal is to do our very best to help alleviate or eliminate pain, but we know that some people are going to have some kind of pain for certain periods of time in their life, and some people deal with pain for a greater part of their life, that's something we wish we could change, but we can't always make the difference that we want to in those areas. And it's just part of the reality of the world we live in. So probably if, when you ask how has the approach to treating pain changed, I'm not sure that it's changed so much in the area of our desire to help people, but maybe the concept of suffering has changed in the minds of the people, and there may be some unrealistic expectation from people that we can spare them all suffering. And as much as we would like to be able to do that, that's not always possible. And so I think that creates confusion when it comes to the end-of-life issues or the issue of pain perception, because people expect that there will be no pain, and it's not always true.
How then has our perception of suffering changed, and does that make a difference then in your work in caring for patients?
Well, not only because the people have realized that a lot of the traditional methods that they use with medications and some procedures aren't helping them, and they come to me when a lot of the things that they've tried haven't helped, and they're hoping that I can relieve them of pain. Is that, I don't know if that answers your question quite, but when it comes to the issue of pain perception in the fetus, that's a different focus, and that was one of the topics that I was going to speak on at the conference, is some of the misconceptions there about pain perception.
And what are misconceptions about pain perception in that developing human?
Well, first of all, there are two definitions of pain that are used. One's a basic science definition, and the other one is more of a psychological definition. And so if you look at it from a basic science perspective, pain is a protective mechanism, and it occurs at the time that tissue damage is taking place. And the psychological perspective or definition of pain is really an interpretation of our response to the damage that's occurring, and it can even be a response to circumstances around you that aren't necessarily causing physical harm, so psychological harm. So those two definitions make a difference in how you look at what is going on in the body of the developing human, and how you treat that developing human in the uterus before it's born. And so when we consider the development of the pain centers, the cortex of the brain, which is the part that most people think is necessary for pain perception, is not really necessary. All of the pain fibers terminate in the lower brain center. So that's something that is really important for people to understand, that the pain perception occurs in the lower brain centers. It's not necessary to have the whole cerebral cortex.
So what does this mean then for that developing human, for this human embryo?
So when you're talking about human embryo, you're looking at the first 8 weeks of development, okay? And during those 8 weeks, at about 7 to 7.5 weeks, the entire system necessary for pain perception is being developed almost simultaneously. And one of the other concepts that you need to realize is that when the structure is there, in the developing human, in all the organ systems, when the structure is there, the function is also occurring simultaneously. It's not a development of units or structures that are put together, and then there's some kind of switch turned on later where the function is now working. The function actually precedes, in some ways, the structure. I don't know if that makes sense. And so this is the same with the nervous system. The the sensory system is already in place when you see the structure there in the embryo. So by 8 weeks, the whole system is functioning, and the embryo is capable of perceiving pain when there's tissue damage. And from 8 weeks on, that system is developing more and more. The sensory and the response system continues to develop. So by 20 weeks, which is the cutoff point for most abortions, the developing human has a very sophisticated nervous system.
What does that then mean for those of us who are life-affirming and care about these developing humans in the womb?
Well, we need to recognize that the developing human is capable of feeling pain when they're being harmed. And that puts a human face on the developing embryo and the fetus that most people don't really recognize, because they have a misconception that, especially early on when we have a harder time relating to that being a human being, that it really is a very highly developed organism. And it's a human being. It's not a batch of cells with no form. It has already the complete form of a human by 8 weeks. And it's been rapidly changing and forming the whole time. And it's a really beautiful process when you look at it.
Let's talk about your other presentation, Legislation and Medical Perspectives on End of Life and How We Can Make a Difference. What is important for us to understand when it comes to end of life issues, and how we can, what we can do as individuals and collectively when it comes to legislation on these end of life issues? What are the medical perspectives that are important for us to understand on end of life issues?
I think, first of all, and I kind of alluded to this earlier, we need to realize that as our knowledge and our technological capabilities are increasing, we've discovered two things. One, that we're more capable than ever before of prolonging health and life, of saving lives and improving the quality of people's lives. But we also realize that we are limited. And in spite of all the successes that we have, we can't control the outcome of our efforts. And we hear a lot of good stories about people's lives being saved, and they're wonderful stories, and it's definitely a testimony to the advances that we've made in medicine. But because of what we hear, we do kind of have some unrealistic expectations of what the outcome could be in every situation. And I think that for both the physicians and the patients, sometimes we're disappointed when our best efforts don't end up producing the outcome we want, which is, you know, for most people, complete restoration of health and of the quality of life that they might be expecting. So you had asked, you know, what we can do, mm-hmm. or what some of the legislative perspectives are.
Right. So
what we need to understand is that because of the changes in the medical system that have created a third-party payer system, whenever we have someone else paying for our care, that person also really ultimately controls the kind of care you get. And so there's a lot of talk about the high cost of treatment at the end of life. And because of that, there's an effort to cut costs. And that cost saving many times means that your treatment is going to be denied because it's not considered valuable treatment at the at if your life expectancy is not good, or if you have a chronic disease. And people don't anticipate that this kind of outcome. I think a lot of times when we talk about this high cost of treatment and what we should do to cut costs, it ultimately means that our care is going to be compromised because we aren't in control of the decision-making anymore, we being the patient, because we have a third party whose interests are going to be more powerful and more dominant, and that would be your insurance payer or, in some cases, the hospital system who's employing physicians. Those entities control the care by controlling what is paid for. Does that make sense?
Right. When other entities are involved in that care or paying for that care, then they also have some sort of invested interest in what's being done in that care and whether or not it's justified, and in the cost of it as well.
That's right. And so they have you create a conflict of interest because the physician is, especially if he's hired by a hospital or another entity that's non-medical, that's not a physician, then someone is controlling his medical judgment. Someone else has an influence over him because he's beholden first to the boss, and he's not accountable to the patient first as a private physician would be. And of course, that third party is always going to be considering the cost of care and is not going to be as interested in the best care for the patient as much as they are in making sure that they're financially stable.
How does this all shape how you care for patients? How do you navigate that as a physician in order to provide the best care for patients? I'm sure that's got to be a challenging and quite burdensome task to be able to navigate all of this, especially in the challenges that our own government and country present when it comes to healthcare.
Well, I think it's becoming more and more of a problem for physicians because not only are they having to answer to a lot of demands on their time by filling out paperwork and dealing with the electronic medical records, and believe me, there are about 157 agencies that all demand a piece of time from that physician before he can ever care for the patient. So it's becoming a problem, and one of two things happen. The physician will fight for the patient's life and spend themselves trying to fight the third-party interest to get the care that the patient needs, or, you know, the human response is to give up, do the best you can, and hope that the outcomes will be okay, knowing that you're not able to give them the best possible care because that care has been hindered. So it's I think, a growing problem. I think a lot of people are recognizing it, and that's why there's anxiety from a lot of people on these issues, especially end of life, because they're not quite sure anymore that the physician has their best interest in mind. They're not sure who the physician is first responsible to.
Sure, and that's a valid question, a legitimate concern, I would think, in my mind anyway.
So that's why we have to be very diligent and pay attention when legislation comes up, because it's going to be the people who have a lot of financial interest in changing legislation in regard to medication and treatment in people's lives that are controlling that legislation. The physicians really don't have that much input in it.
So what can we do then to make a difference?
Well, what I hope to share with people in the conference is ways of recognizing the terminology that's used in legislation, and being very wary of how promote, how this legislation is promoted by the various pro-life groups. Because one of the things that happened is some pro-life groups are being split apart because somebody got bent the ear of one group and got them to get on one side of legislation, and then there are people on the other side, and it confuses people because they all of the people want the same thing, but there's a lot of propaganda that sways different groups on one side or the other. And so I'm hoping to help people learn to recognize that there's a problem when they get conflicting messages from a variety of groups, that they need to go to the legislation itself. And it's not that hard to read. And they need to be able to recognize that even people that they like can be deceived. Even organizations that they trust can be deceived into supporting legislation that they think will help but might actually harm people.
Speaking at the upcoming event, what is the main thing that you hope the listeners, the participants at the conference, the Lutherans for Life conference, will walk away with, Dr. Page?
I'm hoping that I can help people to be able to recognize that there are problems with messaging. That what we can do that's more important than anything else is to strengthen our moral foundation as a society, not allow ourselves to be manipulated by groupthink and other efforts to confuse us about what's right and what's wrong, and to remember to be prepared to not allow boundaries to be moved when it comes to issues like euthanasia and assisted suicide. There are reasons that we as a society have put those boundaries there, and when you allow those boundaries to be moved, you've started to become a self-referencing compass, and it is a slippery slope for people. They don't know how to stop once the boundary's been moved, because we've become our own judge and our own source of moral code, and it typically doesn't work well in the society if we don't hold ourselves to a higher moral code from a lawgiver, and that would be God.
Dr. Sheila Page, Associate Scholar with Charlotte Lozier Institute, board certified in neuromusculoskeletal medicine and osteopathic manipulative medicine. Dr. Page, thank you for being my guest today on Faith and Family. It was most definitely a pleasure to talk with you today.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a little bit, Thy Strong Word. You can find out more about the Lutherans for Life conference. We'll provide a link with with today's archive of the program. But you can find them on lutheransforlife.org. The upcoming conference, October 21st and 22nd at St. Michael's Lutheran Church in Bloomington, Minnesota. You can hear Dr. Page and the Reverend Don Richman, who we spoke with earlier. Tomorrow, we'll talk with two more speakers from the conference, the Reverend Fred Hinz, Advocating for Life Lutherans in the Public Square, and Colonel John Eidsma. We spoke with him last year. This year, he'll be speaking about preachers, politics, and the two kingdoms. What does the IRS allow? You can hear both of them tomorrow here on Faith and Family. You're listening to the Messenger of Good News Worldwide, KFUO. Faith and Family is every day, weekday, here on Worldwide KFUO. If you have a question or a comment for us, send us an email, family@kfuo.org. Be glad to have your questions or comments, or if there's a topic you'd like for us to consider here on Faith and Family, just send me an email, family@kfuo.org. Thy Strong Word up next.
Listen to Faith and Family Monday through Friday at this time. Faith and Family is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is needed for Faith and Family to continue. Our address is 1333 South Kirkwood Road, St. Louis, Missouri, 63122. You can contact us on the web and download Faith and Family at KFUO.org. Worldwide KFUO, on the air, online, and on demand.